the arrest today and some of the trials, and next week we'll talk about the crucifixion, and then I think in 3 weeks, according to my calendar, it's Easter, we'll talk about the resurrection. So we've got a handout coming here that we're going to be handing out. It's got a map on it. But I just want to tell you a little bit about trusting God and safety and all this. We, as I said last week, we're on spring break this last week. Had a great time. We got a lot of work done on the house. Looking forward to school starting again. Have a break. But we had we got six sons, you know, and one was in Chicago. That's where he lives. One's in Colorado on the slopes of the mountains teaching snowboarding. Always trying these new fancy jumps and calls home and tries to tell us about his 15-foot jump and 20-foot jump. It's like, we don't want to hear about it. Just come home for Christmas. And then we send two of the boys to Ireland for a week. And that's an adventure, you know. We just put them on the plane and they fly away. And next thing we can't hear from them. They're overseas. We can't call them on the cell phone. We just check the bank account. We started seeing money go out into Ireland. We realized they're there. And we send Zachary to Washington, D.C. So five of our six sons are like scattered around the world. It's like, you know, it takes great faith. But at least we got Jacob home with us where we can watch him. Two parents for one son. Keep an eye on him. He broke his arm. Everybody else is fine. World travelers flying, jetting all over. They all come home on time, safe, happy, with souvenirs and a little bit of money left over. Zach or Jacob breaks their arm. And it took him three times to do it. He falls out of a tree. Me and Tony were home by ourselves with him. He falls out of a tree. So as good parents, we put an ice pack on it. It'll be okay. Stop crying. He goes up to his room with the ice pack, trips over some stuff in his room, falls on the arm again, cries longer. I told you to leave the ice pack on it. We're busy. We're fixing the house up. Then his brothers come home, and they're playing catch in the front yard with the football, and he's riding his scooter around and has to dodge the football. Yeah, right. It had just happened to be aiming right towards him. And he ducks to get out of the way and lands on his wrist a third time. And this time it's too much. And so after an hour of crying, we take him to the hospital and he comes back with a cast. You know what boys are like. You know the conversation for the next 2 days is who broke the arm? Who threw the ball? I broke his arm. No, it was me. I was the one who threw the ball. And they're all trying to take claim to who broke the brother's arm. So anyway, there's a moral of that story somewhere, but if there's not, just kind of stay with it. Safety is where the Lord wants you, not if mom and dad are there. Open your Bibles, please, to the book of John. I wanted to take time getting ready for Easter. Easter comes every year, you know. Christmas comes every year. And I don't always like to stop and do the Christmas story each year, or stop and do the Easter story each year. It's kind of, you know, mundane. It's a great story. So we try and get different angles on it. But this year, I thought it was time to slow down and go through the details of the Easter story. Some of the things that take place with Jesus' passion, which began in the Garden of Gethsemane. In those notes that I handed to you at the very top of the page, it's got a list of, tells you about Matthew, Mark, Luke. We don't have, everybody's not got a sheet. He's got a broken arm. You got to understand. He can't hand them out as fast as he used to. The Gospels are all written about Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're all absolutely true. But they're each been written for a purpose. To bring about a point. For example, Matthew is to reveal to the Jews that Jesus is the king. And that's kind of, they start with, you can see that in the very beginning with the genealogy. Luke, on the other hand, comes about revealing, is written to the Gentiles or the Greeks, teaching that Jesus was a man. He was a real man and was of the flesh. I mean, not in a sinful state, but he had the body of a man and approaches Jesus that way. Both are true. Jesus was the king. Jesus was a man. Mark approaches it as Jesus as the servant, the one who came to serve, the one who came to fulfill God's plan. Not so much in how he went about it and the things he faced, but he accomplished this mission. That's the book of Mark. And John, as we know, approaches the ministry of Jesus or the person of Jesus as God. It begins, John begins in chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." No information about the birth, no information about, well, as I got written on those notes there, Matthew, Mark, and Luke record the temptations. The temptations that Jesus faced from Satan in the very beginning, the three temptations. Matthew approaches it as the king, Jesus, facing his greatest adversary, Satan, the king of this age, or the prince of this world, and the two meet. The great king meets the imposter king. And that's what the temptation is about. Luke, on the other hand, puts it in a perspective of similar to the temptations that Adam faced when the first man, Adam, fell in the garden. Now you've got Jesus in those temptations, facing those same temptations or similar temptations and succeeding. Mark simply says, as typical of Mark, focusing on the work of the servant, simply says there was a temptation and then he moves on. Don't need to know the details. Did he pass the temptation? Yes, the servant passed, and we're going to the next stage. John doesn't even mention the temptations, because he's not interested in the man Jesus. He's interested in revealing Jesus as the Son of God. Also, the transfiguration, where Jesus, the man, reveals his glory. It's recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John never records the transfiguration where Jesus reveals his glory, because John writes with the impression that Jesus revealed his glory throughout his entire ministry. For example, when he turned water to wine, thus he revealed his glory to his disciples. John sees Jesus as revealing glory throughout his work of his ministry. So now we come to the Garden of Gethsemane. After Jesus had the last meal with the disciples, he had some teaching. We're going through this on Wednesday night, the details of the Last Supper and the things that Jesus taught as they were getting ready to enter into the new dispensation of the church age. Jesus gets up and leaves that meal. They may have walked through the city for a while, but eventually they end up going across the Kidron Valley. If you look on your notes on the back page, there's a map, and I'll give you just a moment to get oriented to it. If you look at that on the left side of your map or on the west side, you've got the city of Jerusalem. If you notice right there, the number 2 is the temple. And that gray part right in the middle of that square, that is the actual temple itself. Fort Antonio Fortress is up there, number 6 and 8. That's where Pilate lives and has his soldiers. Notice Fort Antonio was built right beside the temple so that the Romans could keep an eye on the Jerusalem temple, the Jews' temple. So in case there's ever a revolt, it would break out probably around the temple. They're right there. The whole time during Passover, guards were watching the temple sanctuary and the courtyard, watching it from windows, ready to defend any kind of a revolt that would take place so they could see the temple clearly. Nonetheless, Jesus is going to cross the Kidron Valley. If you look there on the right side of the city, or just to the east of the city, you can see a little line there. It's called the Kidron Valley. He would walk down through that valley and then up to the Mount of Olives. And on the Mount of Olives, you can see the Garden of Gethsemane is number 4. The Garden of Gethsemane was on the Mount of Olives. It's an olive grove. They had olives there. A wine press was there also. In fact, Gethsemane means the place of the press. It was the place of pressure where they'd actually press and to get the oil. Jesus, if you look on number to the left again, on the number 3 on the east side of the city, upper room, there's a question mark there. That is probably where that would be the residence area of where the upper room could have been. Most likely that's where the houses would have been, where a room would have been in a house upstairs where they could have gone. It is most likely, again, speculation as historians have looked at it, it was probably held at the house of a young man. He would be a teenager probably. His name was John Mark. And his mom or his parents would have owned this house, and Jesus would have used the upper room for his last meal with his disciples, which is going to explain some things later. But Jesus would have left number 3 there where the upper room is at, or the house of John Mark. They would have walked through the streets of the city. He would still be teaching. Some of the things we're going to study in the book of John were taught in the upper room. Some of them may have been taught on their way out to the Garden of Gethsemane. But Jesus is going to then leave, cross the Kidron Valley, go out one of the eastern gates of the city, cross the Kidron Valley, and go up the Mount of Olives and go to a familiar place, the place of the press, the Garden of Gethsemane. He would have been there, used this often, because when Judas comes to bring the band of soldiers to arrest Jesus, he's going to know where Jesus is at. Well, Judas is going to leave the Last Supper. Jesus tells him, go and do what you need to do. Do it quickly. Do it as fast as you can. Let's get this thing started. Judas would have taken a band of soldiers, we'll look at this in a minute, and would have then walked probably back to the upper room, to John Mark's house, to find Jesus, realizing they're gone, and said, well, they probably went to the Garden of Gethsemane, and then led the soldiers out to the Garden of Gethsemane as they're tracking Jesus down. That's why they're using Judas to find Jesus. There's millions of people in the city at Passover. So just say, I think he's probably over here. There's just people everywhere. And so Judas is tracking him down, and of course they find him in the Garden of Gethsemane. At the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, as you know, has asked his disciples to pray with him. He's under great distress. In fact, if you look on your notes on the other side then, where it says Gethsemane, I've got some things written out there from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Again, John doesn't record this suffering that takes place at the Gethsemane. Now realize, the passion has begun. Jesus suffered and died on the cross for our sins. But the burden of this, he kept warning the disciples. He says, my heart is troubled. The last week, he says that several times. In the upper room, he says that. Now is the time of darkness. My heart is troubled. He's getting ready to go out here and face the temptation to run, the temptation to come up with some other plan, the temptation to let his human will, and that again is who Jesus is. He's deity and he's human. He is both. That's the hypostatic union, the kenosis talked about in Philippians. He is eternal God, but he is man, a created body. It's a unique relationship. It's a unique thing that we have through Jesus Christ. It is because of that union, Jesus Christ can take the sins of man into his fleshly body, into his own humanity, and pay for them. Well, it's not an easy thing to face the sins of the world, to face separation from God, to pay for the sins of the world. It's not just a snap your fingers and it's done. Because your sins are real, Jesus actually has to suffer to pay for them. It's not just a magic wand, wave them, and the sins are all gone. Because we live in a real world with a God that's created reality, and sin is reality, God has to deal with it in reality. And so Jesus Christ has to become a real man with a real body and actually take and receive the punishment for those sins. It's an incredible concept. It's a concept that has no end to being able to understand it, because it involves eternity. It involves deity. It involves the sins of the world. And it involves the final payment. It's done. It's dealt with. Which is an incredible thing to think about. In Gethsemane, watch this. I've got these things written down. Matthew 26:37. It says that Jesus began to be sorrowful. And the word there he uses, Matthew uses is alupio, which means to make sorrowful, to affect with sadness, to cause grief, to throw into sorrow. Then Matthew adds the word adamonio, which means to be troubled, distressed. Together they mean deeply distressed. Jesus goes after the Last Supper and walking with his disciples and teaching. He goes out to the place of the press and began to be deeply sorrowed, deeply troubled. Something is weighing on him heavily. The disciples, as you know, are oblivious to this. They are still trying to put things together and figure out what's going to take place. It's, in a lot of ways, it's a night like any other night. Jesus is going to go off to the place of the press with his disciples. He's going to pray. They're going to go to sleep. They're going to get the next day and go back into the city of Jerusalem. That's what the disciples are thinking. Jesus realizes this is it. He's now facing the very mission he came to fulfill. Matthew 26:38, Jesus then, after having been described as being very sorrowful or deeply distressed, turns to his disciples in Matthew 26:38 and says, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death." The word here is another word. You can see it written right there. And it means very sad, deeply grieved, exceedingly sorrowful. Okay, we're going on getting redundant here. Mark 14 describes it this way. He began to be deeply distressed and troubled, which means to be struck with amazement or terror. In the sense that this is something Jesus has never really felt or dealt with. He's amazed by it. He is entering into separation from God. He's entering into achieving something that's never been done before or dealt with. It is even foreign to Jesus Christ. He's never dealt with sin in this sense where it's become part of him. It's a terrifying thing. He's amazed. He's astounded. It's brand new. Luke 22:44 used the word agony and anguish, which comes from the Greek word agonia, which we get our word agony. It's a word that is referred to or used in the Greek games when the athletes would struggle and they would agonize. It's an athletic term. And in other sense, Jesus is in the greatest wrestling bout of his life. He's wrestling and struggling. He's agonizing, trying to win this battle. And indeed, it is a battle. Potentially, Jesus could have lost this battle. Okay, potentially. Okay, that's a huge theological debate. Could Jesus really fail? But he is agonizing, struggling with this, trying to put down his human will, his human desire, and accept God's plan for his life. And it wasn't just a matter of saying, now listen, we've all dealt with it. We deal with it in our own lives. Not dealing with this kind of strain, but dealing with where we have got a human will wanting or desiring something, and God's will is to put it down. We agonize. Jesus agonized to a place that we've never experienced. In fact, it's going to say later on in Mark 14, no, excuse me, it's in Luke, because Dr. Luke records it. Only Luke records it. is that he began to sweat great drops of blood, which is very unique because it's a cool night. In fact, later on as we read the story, Peter's going to find a fire to keep himself warm. So Jesus is not hot and sweating up here as he's praying. He is, in his soul, is agonizing, is working so hard mentally that because of the strain and the stress on his body, his skin begins to separate and the blood vessels begin to separate and blood begins to come through the pores. Just like sweat comes out, he is bleeding internally throughout his body, coming through those pores. And drops of sweat or blood were falling off of his body. This is extreme. This is possible to take place just because of emotional stress. We've all had trouble. We've all had distress, some more than others. But this kind of emotional stress is very, very rare. It is the most intense form of stress that anyone can undergo. And Jesus Christ faced it in His humanity and pressed through it. Listen, I have collapsed myself in the face of temptation. I have collapsed in the face of putting down my human will. And I've taken on the human will instead of doing God's will. I have failed. And I've struggled. Hebrews says we've struggled against sin, but not to the place of shedding blood. You think you struggle. Jesus Christ struggled beyond anything we can compare to and succeeded. His strength is our strength. The Spirit of God is now abiding within us. We studied that on Wednesday night. We're going to see it over and over again throughout the Scriptures. God has given us the Spirit of God. We are now in union with Christ. And when we struggle against sin, when we struggle with our own human will, we do not need to fight just in our own human strength, but the Spirit of God is with us so that we can overcome. Listen, the simple, easy temptations that we face when compared to what Jesus dealt with. Again, they're not easy to us, but because of the Spirit of God, we should be able to succeed. Nonetheless, Gethsemane, Jesus has been praying. He prayed for an hour. He prayed for 2 hours. He may have arrived between 12 o'clock and 1 o'clock. Realize how late this is going to get. He's not going to go to sleep tonight. He leaves the upper room, say 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. They go out to the Kidron Valley for an hour. He finds his disciples still asleep, prays for another hour. So it's pushing 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock possibly, 2:30 this time right here. And it's time. Jesus rises and it's time to meet Judas and the band of soldiers. So if you would please go to the book of John. John chapter 18. And after doing this and dealing with this stress, Jesus arises, goes out into the open, and coming is a band of soldiers. Now, this band of soldiers, the word that is used here is a cohort, which is about 600 soldiers. Okay, are you ready? I got a lot of information, so just, you know, do the best you can at country. If you get bored, you know, read the bulletin, find a Proverbs, read the Proverbs or something. My boys do that all the time. What'd you do today in church? I got bored, so I read Proverbs. So go ahead, just, you know, I'm just here entertaining. So if I can't keep up, you know, go ahead. But a cohort of soldiers would be about 600. It's a legion was 6,000 soldiers. And a legion was made up of 10 divisions or cohorts of 600 soldiers. So you've got 6,000 in a legion. They pull out a division or a cohort of 600. Judas is assigned 600 Roman soldiers. Now, Judas is not coming out there with the Roman soldiers alone. Judas is working for who? The high priest, the Sanhedrin. During Lazarus, when Lazarus was raised about a month before this time, when Lazarus was raised, the Sanhedrin got together and made the decision, we've got to kill Jesus. Now watch how this is working. The Sanhedrin is the ruling class. They're like the Senate. They're like the judicial branch of the government of Israel. Their job was to hear cases, hear the accusations, hear the defense, and make a decision. In this case, the greatest, there are two great manifestations of government and judicial ruling classes in history. One is the law of Moses, the Sanhedrin, Israel's. And the other is Rome. In both cases here, the greatest religious system and the greatest government or judicial system are going to collapse. They're going to fail. It's when we read this, it's amazing that an innocent man like Jesus can be found guilty in front with the Mosaic law and then condemned to death in Roman law. Because both of them are, even as the trial progresses, I'm hoping to show that to you, as the trials progress, Jesus, in the end, is innocent. I mean, they both prove he's innocent and decide to kill him. Even as they're trying to do pervert justice, their efforts prove the innocence of Jesus. But just like we said, in Lazarus' time, after Lazarus was raised, they end up deciding, we must kill Jesus. Now, 2 days before the Passover, it also mentions, 2 days before the Passover, they says, we've got to kill Jesus. But they decided 2 days before the Passover, we're going to wait. Wait until the Passover is over. And then when everybody's leaving town, the celebrations are over, and people are on their way out of town, we'll then grab Jesus and execute him without the public knowing what's going on. So that was their plan. But about this time, Satan began to deal with Judas. And Judas made a decision. He decided to follow Satan's plan. And he goes to the high priest and says, I will betray Jesus. I will bring him to you. And they realize this is a great opportunity. They realize that we've got to push things ahead of schedule. So even the Sanhedrin and all their planning, the high priest and all their scheming are now being shoved ahead of time. And they're doing something tonight that they weren't planning on doing for another week or so as they're putting their plan together. So everything is out of control. They're moving faster than they expected, and Satan is actually directing this thing through Judas. Judas comes and comes to them and makes the deal, the 30 pieces of silver. We may talk about that as we go here. The high priest is going to come out with Judas with the temple guard. So the high priest is going to be there. The high priest's servant is going to be standing right there and got his ear cut off. We're going to read about that here in a moment. Peter's going to cut off the high priest's servant's ear as he tried to crush his skull. So the high priest's servant is standing close enough to Jesus to get his ear cut off. That means the high priest is standing right there. So who is arresting Jesus? The high priest. With his battalion of temple guards that came with him. And then backing them up is the 600 Roman soldiers, which are merely there for backup. The Romans are not arresting Jesus. The high priest is, but he needs help in case a revolt breaks out. Like Judas or Jesus starts swinging a sword and the disciples all jump out with, you know, atomic weapons or something like this. And they need to have this backup. So it's going to be on a basis. There are going to be about 1,000 men arresting Jesus, which would be about 100 for every disciple. 100 men for every disciple. They've got them outnumbered. So chapter 18, verse 1, here we begin. John chapter 18, verse 1. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley after the upper room. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now, Judas, now I want you to notice right here what John does. Remember, John's purpose is to portray Jesus and bring out his deity from the very beginning. In the beginning was the Word. So where's all the suffering? It's not here because he's focusing on Jesus' deity. Do you understand what I'm saying? To write a book about Jesus would be massive. So you've got to decide, what are you going to try and bring home? I'm going to show that he's the king. I'm going to show that he's the servant. I'm going to show that he's humanity. In John's case, I'm going to show that he's God. So he doesn't need the temptations to deal with. And plus, they've already been recorded. Verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place. Because Jesus had often met there with his disciples at Gethsemane, the press. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers, there's the cohort, and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. The torches and lanterns was because it was dark in case people started to hide, because you're going to figure Jesus is going to hide. When they get out there, Jesus is going to be hiding behind a tree or something. They got all these torches, you're going to have to look for him. They've got the weapons and they're all armed so they can defend themselves and arrest Jesus. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked. See this? He goes out. He sees them coming. He knows it's time. He's already dealt with it. He's already won the battle. Guess where? In prayer. He's already won the battle of putting his own will down and taking God's. It's over for him. He's now on the fast track. He's won the battle. He's going to do this. And the only reason you can see Jesus, it is amazing. The only person that's going to be able to keep their head from this point throughout crucifixion, the only one who's not going to say something stupid like, well, what is truth? Like Pilate's going to say. Or the high priest, the former high priest, the godfather of Jerusalem, Annas is going to end up saying, we're going to see that in a minute, is going to be completely out of control. Jesus is the only one who doesn't miss a beat. How come? He's already dealt with it in prayer. Interesting. Jesus asked his disciples to pray with him. Peter falls asleep. So at the arrest, Peter is the one who is flinging and flaying, coming up with all kinds of bad ideas, cutting off people's ears, running, denying. And the thing is, potentially, again, if Peter had been in prayer and was able to take his will and get it in line with God, there would be no cutting off of ears. There would be no denying of Christ. he would have stayed the straight and steady course. But because Peter slept instead of prayed, when it all starts to happen, Peter's flinging and flanking with all kinds of dumb ideas because he's running on human volition, human decision. Jesus now, like I said, has won the battle. He steps out and presents himself to 1,000 soldiers with Judas the high priest. Who are you looking for? Jesus of Nazareth. They got their weapons, they got their torches, they're all backing each other up. We're looking for him. He's very, very dangerous. Now again, the Roman guards, are they followers of Christ? They may have heard of his name, but again, remember, although they say this thing didn't happen in a corner and it's well known, the Roman soldiers really haven't been paying attention to Jesus' ministry. They may have heard of his name, they may have heard this. They're getting most of their information from who? The Sanhedrin, the chief priests, the religious leaders. And Jesus has been portrayed as a very, very dangerous criminal. We must have many people with us because his defense system, he's probably got some kind of arsenal out there. We've got to be careful. Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. Now notice this right here. In the Greek, the word he, as we've seen so many other times in the book of John, the word he is not there. This simply says, I am. The NIV translates it, I am he. Jesus identifying himself. But he falls short of simply just identifying himself and takes it another level and uses the name for the Old Testament God. He says, I am. Now, if that's not what's taken, he's used it before and they've gotten mad at him for claiming to be God. If that is not enough, just watch what happens. I am, Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with him, hadn't kissed him yet. There's no kiss yet. Jesus is going to have identified himself and all this is going to take place. And then Judas is going to say, oh yeah, I'm supposed to identify. This is Jesus. And gives him a kiss. So Jesus identifies himself without the kiss. He's not running, oh yeah, you caught me, it's me. He says, when Jesus said, verse 6, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. In other words, just so everybody knows this, this is God speaking. You are about to bind the unbindable God. You're about to take the omnipotent God and reduce him to what? Handcuffs? But before you do, I just want to mention my name. And when he says, I am, they all fall to the ground. Not in worship, because if it was a worship, if this was a camp meeting, this was some kind of a conversion experience, this whole chapter would change. They're not falling in respect. They're falling because they have no other choice. This is reminiscent of what takes place in Revelation 19. When Jesus returns to fight against the Antichrist, and it says he fights with the sword that comes from his mouth. Well, what do you think he's going to do? What, is he going to have a sword dangling out of his mouth? The sword that comes from his mouth is going to be his word, or simply identifying who he is. I am. It is the revelation, that's why they call the book of Revelation, it is the revealing of who Jesus Christ is to the natural world, and everything stops. And right here, this is just a little preview of what it's going to be like. Facing the armies of the Antichrist, when he appears and says, I am, boom. Zechariah, last chapter of Zechariah records, their flesh melts on their bones. They just dissolve. That's scripture. He says, I am, and they all fell to the ground. So at this point right here, they're all like staggering, and they have no power over themselves. Jesus, of course, uses this opportunity to run and hide behind an olive tree. He stands there and waits for them to regain their composure and ask them again, who is it you're looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. I told you, I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go. So he's got his disciples. He says, notice, thinking of them. He says, if you're looking for me, let these go. But you win. The battle's over. I can't run. So he had, let these people go, and we'll deal with this right here. Now, this happens so that the words might be full. I've not lost any of those that you wanted. Verse 10. The other Gospels record this, but only John gives the name of who does it. Now, there's been speculation on why. Some say that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written before the fall of Jerusalem and the Sanhedrin was still in power. So if they would have found out who cut the servant's ear off, they could have arrested Peter, who was one of the leaders in the city of Jerusalem as a Christian. So when John writes, Jerusalem has fallen, it's 15 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. So the Sanhedrin is obviously not in power then, so there's no threat here to identify Peter. Nonetheless, maybe John just wants to make sure you know who it was. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword. Now, that's a good translation, it's a sword. But the Greek word is makarios, which means a ceremonial sword or a large knife. It's like a hunting knife. But it's actually used for sacrifice. Ceremony, something they do for sacrifice. It's a small razor-sharp knife used for sacrifice. Maybe they use it to prepare the Passover lamb, or they're going to use it for some kind of, you know, the sacrifice that they're preparing for the Passover meal. Okay? But Peter's got this concealed in his belt somewhere. He's ready. Now, he's seen the Roman soldiers, or at least heard stories about the Roman soldiers, who had another type of knife, which is called a rompion, which is a larger sword. It's a battle sword. And this is what the Roman soldiers carried. And they were trained in the sense that they could take a helmet of their enemy and they could swing that thing, and they were precise that they could hit it right on where the place was soldered and crack the what do you call those? Helmets. Crack the helmet and crush the skull. So they were trained. They could bring this thing up and crush a helmet and a skull with one swing with these huge swords. And there's 600 of these guys with these swords ready to crush someone's skull. Well, Peter's heard stories about this. And Peter's been bragging. Remember at the Last Supper? He said, if everyone else denies you, I will go with you to your death. Jesus says, Peter, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. No, I'm with you. And right here, as we talked Wednesday night, Jesus is standing there in all of His glory. Everybody's just falling down. This is Peter's signal. It's time for me to fight. Fight like Samson. Fight like the judges of old. I'll take on the Philistines by myself with my little hunting knife. And so he brings it up over like this, and he's going to crush the skull of the high priest's servant, apparently. Now, it doesn't say this, but you can tell he missed by about 3 inches. And take off the guy's ear. Now, he wasn't trying to... He's not trying to cut off ears. Anybody else come along, cut your ear off too. He's trying to crush a skull like a Roman soldier. And a little short knife. Oh! And now we've got a situation. Because now... all chaos could break out because you've got Peter up there swinging a sword. You've got the bloody ear laying on the ground of the high priest's servant. And you've actually now got a crime. See what I'm saying? You now have a crime that you can base this on. And Jesus doesn't want a crime. He's innocent. He's not going to fight with a sword. In fact, that's where he tells Peter, put away your sword. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. There's a little verse for capital punishment if you don't know what that's talking about. He says, if you're going to live by the sword, who lives by the sword? Criminals live by the sword. Soldiers don't live by the sword. They use the sword to protect their country, or the government uses it to bring about justice. Who makes a living with a sword? A criminal. He says, you live by the sword of a criminal, you will die by the sword of the government. In other words, if you're going to live like a criminal, the government's got every right to kill you, Peter. And if you're going to do this, you're going to die as a criminal, not as a martyr. We're not here to die as criminals in the Romans' eyes. We're here to do what's right. So what Jesus does is what? Touches the guy's ear. In fact, if we read, well, I'm not going to show it to you, but if you go back to one of the Gospels, where it says this, Jesus, the translation is translated different ways, but basically they've come to arrest him, and the ear is laying on the ground. Peter's just lopped off the guy's ear. Jesus looked at, apparently, the guys that were arresting the soldiers, says, and basically says, allow me this. Meaning, can I do something? Can you give me just one, I ask request, one thing. Touch the guy's ear, says, okay, let's go back to what we were doing. And gets Peter back in line. And removes the evidence, and Peter's free to go. And at that time, the disciples scatter. So let's read on, please. Verse 11. Oh, it mentions the servant's name, too. Oh, hey, by the way, just in passing right here. John mentions the servant's name, mentions Peter. Malchus, possibly here, would still be alive. Potentially. And so, as they throw around these names, it's interesting that in this day, these names could have been looked up and checked on. Did he really cut your ear off? Well, yeah. Can't you tell? This one looks better than the other one. Jesus fixed this one. I was born with this one. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Whew. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? That says a lot just about your Christian life. That says a lot about living for God. I've got the cup I would like to drink. But God's given me this cup. And in Jesus' case, it wasn't a pleasant cup. In fact, it was a glorious cup. It was a cup of victory. It was a cup that changed the history of the world. But for Him, the servant, to do it was a great price. And the same thing, the cups that God gives us to drink, that maybe we don't want to drink, are not negative and destructive and bad in that sense, although they may cost us something. They may hurt. They may seem bad. But the cup that God gives us to drink is always a cup filled with victory. Always a cup that's going to be history changing. If you will follow this pattern. Maybe history changing in your own life. Maybe history changing in your family's life or your community. But things are going to change if you'll drink the cup. Yeah, but it's going to hurt. just like Jesus' case, it's going to be a cup that's going to be very painful, but the positive results are huge. Nonetheless. Now it goes on and says, now, if you look on your notes, I've got written at the bottom of the page right there, there are six trials, and we're going to try and go through the first three trials today. Then next week, we're going to pick up the last three trials and the crucifixion, if I can pull this off. And a lot of times we just think that there's, well, I'm not sure what you think. But I'm going to show you that there's a sequence. And now this is about 2:30 in the morning. 2:30 in the morning. Assuming Jesus got out about 1 o'clock, he's prayed, they've arrested him. They're going to bring him to the high priest. And I've got to introduce some things to you. His name's Annas, A-N-N-A-S. We'll just call him the Godfather from now on. He's the Godfather of Jerusalem. Annas was brought to Jerusalem by Herod the Great on invitation. He invited him. Remember, Herod the Great died around 4 B.C. This is 30 A.D. or so. So some almost 40 years ago, Herod the Great invited Annas to come from Alexandria, Egypt, up into Jerusalem. And he was the high priest. Annas was going to serve as the high priest around like 8 A.D. I mean, this was like 20 years before. He was the high priest for 5 years. And when the Romans came after Herod's death, they realized this man's got too much power. He's like high priest for life. He was a young man back then. And the Romans don't like competition. They'd always neutralize any competition. And Annas, or the high priest, is a competition that the Romans don't want to deal with. A high priest for life has the people's loyalty. So they removed him. And between... Now the Romans removed him, but in the people's eyes, he never left. He remained the... And again, the high priests at this time were not... They were not what we consider godly men. There had been, between the closing of the Old Testament and the New Testament, there had been two or three men. One guy's name is Onias, O-N-I-A-S, Onias, who was known as the Prince of the Covenant. He was a great man, a great leader, a righteous man who was a high priest. So they had some. But mainly the priesthood had become a position of power, of political and financial power. Annas, for example, had changed the whole system. Are you still with me? Annas had come from Herod, from Alexandria, Egypt. He had been the high priest, been removed by the Romans, but had continued in power kind of in the underground. He had had 5 sons serve as high priest. So Annas himself had 5 sons who had been high priest. His son-in-law, Caiaphas, who is the current high priest, well, that's his son-in-law. And after, this is going to be one of his grandsons is going to be high priest. So although Annas has not been the high priest, there's going to be 7 of either his sons, son-in-laws, or grandsons that are going to be in the actual voting, controlling position. And don't think for a minute they ever went against dad or grandpa. He controlled it. They had set up the system, and you saw Jesus turn the tables over. Remember Jesus turned the tables over twice? At the beginning of his ministry, at the end of his ministry? He was turning over and upsetting Annas' system, his money system. These are some things he did. They would have money changers because they couldn't use foreign coins, Gentile coins in the temple, so you'd have to bring the foreign coins and convert them into Jewish coins. And of course, there was a small fee that kept going up. So that's a win-win situation for Annas. They also had priests who were set aside specifically to inspect your sacrifice. Like if you brought a lamb from home that you'd been watching like you're supposed to be over a period of time, he'd prove to be a perfect a lamb without blemish, and you're going to bring it as a Passover. You're a righteous family following the law of Moses. You'd have to bring it through the priest, and they'd have to inspect it. Of course, there was a small fee to pay the inspector of the sheep. This wasn't like a government program where you're going to inspect. You had to pay for the inspection. And then if that high priest decided, no, sorry, this doesn't qualify, I don't like the color of his eyes, we're going to have you purchase one of our special temple-provided lambs. So they could make money either in changing the money, they could make money in inspecting your lamb, and if they rejected your lamb, they would make money selling you a lamb. In other words, it was a huge profit-making business for Annas. And so he just kept getting stronger and stronger. In fact, there is still recorded, and you can read about it, around the temple, not in the temple, because he's already had the temple under control. He already had the booths and all the money changers set up in the temple. But as soon as you left the temple, you walked across the street, guess what? There's the shopping malls. You won't believe who owns the shopping malls and all the territory around the temple. That's right, the Godfather. He owned the shopping malls around there where you could buy all your fruit, your clothing, everything. So once you got into that part of Jerusalem, anything you spent went into his pocket. Jesus made him mad, you remember, when he turned the tables over, drove everybody out. So him and Jesus are not friends. Anyway, he was the one that was in charge. We're going to now read in chapter 18, verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had prophesied or advised the Jews that it would be good for if one man died for all the people. Here's one of Peter's denials. We're going to skip through that right here. Verse 19. Meanwhile, while Peter's denying, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. This is nothing more than Jesus finally meeting face to face with the Godfather. It's in a dark room somewhere. Actually, it's in a courthouse at his house. They take him to his house. If you look on the map on the back of your page, you've got right there, it says the high priest palace. There's a couple ways of understanding this. That is where the high priest palace was at. Caiaphas would have lived there. There would have been a large room there where they would have had meetings with pillars and columns. And they would have had a meeting there. There would have been a courtroom where an open area with the sky open where they could have come into and stood in this courtroom. And then the rooms would have been off this courtyard. And it's a palace, the high priest palace. Couple of things. Caiaphas definitely lives there in number 5 at the high priest palace. It is possible that Annas, the godfather, had his own room or his own section somewhere in there. Or Annas' place was somewhere else in Jerusalem. But nonetheless, they're going to take him to a place. And in this case, Annas is going to meet with him alone, with his servant. And they're going to meet with Jesus alone. There's no Sanhedrin. There's no Caiaphas. There's no high priest here. It is the Godfather. So you know where this thing's starting. This thing is not starting with the high priest Caiaphas. It's starting with his father-in-law, who's been controlling Jerusalem for years, and Jesus is about ready to tip the balance against him. So we've got to snuff Jesus out. This is all about power. It's all about money. It's all about controlling his little kingdom in this world, and he's going to get rid of Jesus. So Jesus brought in. Now, when you're brought for trial, again, this is a trial, but it's not really a trial. When you're brought in for a trial, you need to be accused of something. There has to be charges. A witness has come against you. Here's the charges. You don't just get arrested and brought in, we're going to put you in jail. Well, what for? Well, we haven't decided yet, but you're going to jail. Or, we're going to execute you. Well, what for? We don't know, but we're going to find something. That's what Jesus did. They've decided to kill Jesus. Well, what are his charges? Don't know yet. We'll get them. And this is, again, 2:30 in the morning. Jesus is going to be on the cross at 9. So you've got to figure Pilate's last trial had to be at least over by 8:30, so he's got half an hour to get the cross, probably at least 8 o'clock, because you got to carry the cross, you know, he's got to nail him and get it all stood. Yeah, I know the Romans are efficient, but this is going to take him some time to get this whole thing done. So between 2:30 and let's say 8:30, that would be, well, how many hours is that? 6. Jesus is going to appear before Annas. He's then going to appear before Caiaphas, the high priest, with some of the Sanhedrin, but then they're going to have the official meeting during daylight. So as the sun's coming, they're going to have the official meeting, which is going to be the third trial. Then he's going to go to Pilate. We're going to knock on Pilate's door right after the sun's come up, and he's going to stand before Pilate. And Pilate's going to find out, you're from Galilee. Well, King Herod's in town. He's in charge of Galilee. Why don't we take this whole mess over to King Herod? There. Got rid of that. So now he's going to have to stand trial before King Herod, which is the fifth trial, and King Herod's going to say, this guy's a lunatic. I don't find anything wrong with him. Send him back to Pilate. And then he's going to stand before Pilate another time. So between 2:30 in the morning and, let's say, 8:30, he's going to be by the Godfather, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, Pilate, Herod, and back to Pilate. That's 6 trials in about 6 hours. That's not very efficient, especially when they've already made the decision. We're going to kill him after we get on these trials. We just got to find out how we're going to do it. It takes them 6 trials to get him killed. And every one of the trials, I can show you, every one of the trials, he proves himself to be faultless. How would you like to stand before a court, a judge who's trying to find something wrong, and after they get all done accusing you, it's like, they can't find anything. Well, let's look at this right here. Annas, the Godfather, speaking to Jesus. There's no Sanhedrin. There's no judge or jury. This is the judge trying. He's going to send him to the high priest in just a minute, but they don't have any charges yet. He's trying to find a charge. Meanwhile, the high priest Annas questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Wait. You drag I'm going to speak like Jesus here. Jesus, he's not quoted here. This is not his attitude, though. You be the judge. They bring him in at 2:30 in the morning. So tell us about yourself. Tell us about what you've been teaching. Name some of your disciples. Tell us a little bit about your ministry. Why am I here? Well, we just want to know some information about you. And in other words, they have no charge. They've got no crime. What Annas is trying to do is get Jesus to say something, to reveal something that he... that's wrong. And then condemn him to death for it. Jesus knows that this is a trial without a crime. This is a trial without accusers. This is a trial without any witnesses. This is a trial with a set purpose. We're going to kill you, but we just got to fill in the gaps. So Jesus, being the truth, being wise, is going to point this out. He's asking him about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus, my friends, is not going to tell him anything. Jesus is going to plead the fifth. Listen, you're the one with the problem. Again, he doesn't say that directly. I'll read what he says in a minute. You're the one that wants to accuse me. What is your problem? What are you accusing me of? I plead the fifth. I'm not bringing myself to trial. I'm fine. You're the one with the problem. What have I done? He says, after he's asking questions about his disciples and his teaching, and Jesus simply says, I've spoken openly to the world. In other words, there's nothing you don't know. If you want information, it's out there. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. He says, first of all, everything I've ever said and my disciples, it's all been in the open. I've got nothing to hide. And then he gives them a clue. Do you want witnesses? Try the temple, the synagogue, the Jews. They heard me teach. What is he telling them? You need witnesses, Annas. You're trying to get me killed, but you need witnesses. Let me help you out. Go to the temple. Go to the synagogue. Go to the Jews. They know everything. I always taught in the synagogues or the temple where all the Jews come together. Then he says, I said nothing in secret. Contrary to what's been going on among the Sanhedrin, everything I've said has been in the open. There's nothing I can tell you that you can't get from a witness. In other words, by law, Jesus is not required to testify against himself. Tell us what you did wrong. Wait, isn't that your job? My job is to be accused of what I've done wrong, not to tell you what I've done wrong. If you've got something against me, go get your witnesses. I did nothing in secret. It's all out there. I said nothing in secret. Then he says, watch, why question me? You're questioning the wrong guy. You need to question the witnesses. Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. In other words, Jesus said, like I said, he said, I'm not going to tell you anything. It's out in the open. Go find a witness. Why don't you ask your witnesses? Now this is, if you don't notice, this is very offensive. He basically told Annas, the godfather, I ain't talking. You're the one with the problem. Go find your witnesses. So much so that without any direction, watch this next verse. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him on the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest, he demanded. Notice what he calls him, the high priest. He's the high priest in the Jewish eyes, but not the acting high priest. Nonetheless, he still has that power. And Jesus is simply pleading the fifth, saying, go ask the witnesses. And in other words, he says, you've got the problem, Annas. You haven't got any witnesses. You don't have a crime. And they slapped him in the face. And Jesus says to them, if I said something wrong, testify as to what I did wrong. He says, what did you slap me for now? Now what have I done wrong? I'm not even in violation of any law, let alone now the violation of this court. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Now watch. This is the godfather, Annas, getting shut down by truth. Watch his next action. What does Annas do next? Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. In other words, that's the end. It's like he didn't get any information. Jesus pleaded the fifth and says, you need witnesses. Why don't you find your witnesses? You don't even have a case yet. They slap him. He says, now you slap me. Now what have I done wrong? I'm still innocent. Annas sends him down to Caiaphas. Now, what's been taking place between Jesus' arrest and this right here is the Sanhedrin's been being woken up because this thing happened fast. And the Sanhedrin is a group of 70 men of the leaders of Israel. Every city, every community, every town had a synagogue. And wherever there was 120 men assembled in a local synagogue or a local church like what we have here, anytime there was 120 men, there would then be required that they would take 23 men out of those 120 and form a synagogue or form a Sanhedrin, a local Sanhedrin, the local ruling class that would govern the city under Jewish law. Every town had that. But then in Jerusalem was the great Sanhedrin of 70 men. Sometimes they came from these other cities, but they were 70 men. And the Sanhedrin would work like this. They'd have the 70 leaders. In front of them would be the want-to-bes, those that were studying, sitting on the floor. This is how far Paul got, the Apostle Paul. He got to the floor, apparently, where the 70 Sanhedrin would sit and make the decisions in a court case situation, and they'd discuss things. Then in the front of the floor would be all the students, the wannabes, who were on their way to becoming a Sanhedrin. And Paul says, I was advancing beyond anyone my age. Talking about he was moving quickly. He was just years, months away from getting invited to a seat of the Sanhedrin. And he was sitting at the feet of Gamaliel. That was his student. He would sit in front of Gamaliel, which was one of the great members of the Sanhedrin, still recorded today. So here's the Sanhedrin of 70. You got the students that were sitting here, the wannabes, and then you bring in the one that is accused and the witnesses. Now, the Sanhedrin is going to assemble. They do not bring charges. They do not go out and find somebody. They accept charges. This person is guilty and they find something wrong with them. Jesus now is in a different situation. Caiaphas is now, he's going to be taken to Caiaphas' house. And let's go, please, let me see in my notes here. We want to go next to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. And the Sanhedrin is being woken up. Hey, we got a trial. Now, first of all, one of the laws of Moses, all the trials were during the daytime. You can't have a nighttime trial. Also, I mean, there's so many rules I could go over with you here, but I know you're getting stressed anyhow. But the rules, you had to have the meeting during the day. And if you accuse someone of a crime that involved murder and resulted in capital punishment, are you with me? There would always, in a Sanhedrin, there would always have to be of the 70 men, one man who would defend the accused, even if it was clear murder. I mean, this guy is clearly, he's still got the blood on his hands and the weapon in his hand. I mean, this guy killed the guy. One guy would have to step aside and say, yes, but, and play the guy's attorney to help the guy out. That was the rule. Then you had to have the daytime trial, and if a guy was accused of a crime that involved capital punishment, was going to be executed, they had to sit solemnly and quietly and reflect on it, trying to think of any angle why this may not be correct, and wait until the next day to perform the execution. Upon which time they'd reassemble, they'd go over it. If anybody had anything that they needed to say, they would say any last-minute questions. Then they'd take the accused person and march them off to their destination for execution while the Sanhedrin sat and waited and thinking. If there's any reason why we missed something or why we made a mistake, if a witness all of a sudden would pop up and go, wait, I just remembered something. They'd flag him down and bring the accused back and hear what that witness had to say. Nope, I still think he's guilty. And they'd set a very solemn ceremony as they led someone to their execution. Now, again, it would take a period of time. Now in chapter 26, verse 57. This is the second trial. He's been before Annas, the second trial. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law, that's the Sanhedrin, and the elders had assembled. What is it, 3:30 in the morning? They're just assembling for a trial at 3:30 in the morning? But Peter, now again, they may not all have been there. Guys like Nicodemus, Joseph Arimathea, who are believers, who have believed in Christ as the Messiah, they may not have been invited. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. And that would definitely be on your map right there, that high priest palace number 5. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. He did the same thing at Annas' house, was by the fire. Now he goes in by the fire, and this time he sits down. The first time he stood by the fire at Annas' house. The second trial, oh yeah, I've been here before, and sits down and gets a little comfortable. The chief priest, Caiaphas, and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. That sounds like a fun trial. We already mentioned that. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. People are saying something, but they're contradicting each other. Now watch. Finally, two came forward and declared. Now here's an accusation. Two men are going to say, I'm going to read to you from Matthew, I'm going to read to you from Mark what the two witnesses say. But even then they're going to contradict each other. But they're both taking it out of context. We'll go to John and see what Jesus really said. Here is what Caiaphas, the high priest, got on Jesus that night Now they got him in the courtyard. Remember that open area of the palace? See the stars, the fire's burning. Peter's sitting out there keeping himself warm. He can look in here to the right or to the left or wherever he's at. Enter past the pillars and see in this big room the Sanhedrin still coming in, still waking up. Caiaphas, the high priest, in there. And Jesus is still bound. Bound like a criminal. He's been bound since the Garden of Gethsemane. He's gone through Annas. Now he's standing there. And they can see this, and they're bringing in witnesses. Probably out here in the courtyard, they're asking people, did you hear him say? And they say, here's somebody. And they try this guy. And then he would be like, no, not good enough. And they're trying to find somebody to bring an accusation against Jesus. Finally, from this courtyard here, they bring somebody and two guys that say this. Finally, two came forward, verse 61, and declared, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, I want you to pay kind of close attention if you're interested. If you're not, just keep reading the bulletin. I am able, he says, I am able. This man says he has the power, the ability, the dunamis, to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. So in other words, if they're going to prove that case right there, the issue with that accusation, says he's able. The issue now is Jesus able? The accusation is he says he's got the power. Now we've got to find out if he's got the power or not. But notice right here, please go to the book of Mark, Mark 14. Same story, but here's maybe the other witness, Mark 14, verse 57. Mark chapter 14, verse 57. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days will build another. Not made by man. Yet even then, it says, but look at verse 59. The two witnesses, yet even then their testimony did not agree. They're both quoting what Jesus said, but they're both wrong. They don't even agree with each other. Why? Well, if you go to John chapter 2, please, stay with me. John chapter 2, this is what Jesus actually said. One says, he says he's got the ability to destroy the temple made by God. Another one says, he says that he will do this. He'll destroy the temple not built by, and build one that's not built by hands. Well, in John chapter 2, verse 19, this is what they're trying to quote. Verse 18, something Jesus said at the very first Passover he went to when he cleared the temple the first time. Let's read verse 18. Then the Jews demanded of him, what miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? Clear the temple and destroy the Godfather's money-making business. Whose authority do you have? We're working on Annas' authority. Whose authority do you have? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. He says, destroy this. You destroy this. He never said he was going to destroy any temple. He says, you destroy the temple, and I will build it again in 3 days. So anyway, that's their accusation. Let's go back to Matthew, please. Verse 62, after these two contradictory testimonies that aren't even accurate, verse 62, then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? This is Caiaphas speaking. What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. He goes, I can't believe what I'm hearing. They say you're going to destroy the temple of God. What are you going to say in response to this? Now remember, this has been like an hour and a half, a two-hour ordeal of trying to find an accusation against Jesus. And finally they've got one. That he said something about he would destroy the temple, which is a false quote. That's all they've got. Obviously he left the Godfather's house innocent because the Godfather got mad and sent him down the road. Now here it is right here. They're saying, what is going on? What are you going to say? Jesus will say nothing. The high priest said to him, watch. Why does Jesus break his silence? Because the high priest puts him under an oath. I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now this is the truth. He spoke the truth to Annas. He's keeping his mouth shut because he's in a court case. They're trying to bring accusations against him. And now he says, okay, an oath by the living God. Tell us plainly, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Well, what's Jesus going to do? Remain silent? He's going to say, well, no. Nah. Jesus is now forced to answer with the truth. So he says, yes, it is as you say. You said it. But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on clouds of heaven. I'll say clouds of glory. In other words, he says, yes, it is as you say, but he says, let me tell you, this is not my final resting place. He says, tell us plainly, are you the Christ? He says, it's just like you say, but understand, you are all going to see me seated at the right hand of God the Father and coming on the clouds of heaven. So please, be careful with what you're about to do. In other words, yes, I am the Christ, but don't be deceived. I look like anybody else, but I'm not. I'm going to be seated with God in glory, and I will return, and the coming clouds of heaven is a reference to the day of judgment. I will be, listen, he's saying, I'm going to be your judge. It's a statement of mercy. He says, you're sitting in me in judgment now, but there's a day coming when I will return as the judge of all men. So please, move slowly with what you're about to do. Well, obviously, here's the high priest acting in all of his dignification. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, now this is all dramatic. This is all drama, trying to get everybody in a frenzy. He rips his clothes as a sign of mourning and blasphemy. He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? This is what they wanted the first time. We can't find witnesses. Let's get him to testify something false. Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? Now this, again, I know I'm dragging on and on here. But at this point, remember, it's supposed to be a solemn ceremony. They're going to condemn this man to death. Solemn ceremony. And what they would do, they'd all have a stone in each hand. And there'd be two jars. One would be the guilty and one would be the innocent jar. And they'd come up with their stones in their hands. They'd put both hands in the jar. No one could see. And they'd release one stone. And then they'd walk away. It would take a little bit of time for 70 men to come up with their stones, put them in the jar, make their vote, and move on. And very solemn, people remaining in prayer, sometimes in a state of fasting as they're making these decisions. Here, watch, middle of the night, rips his clothes. What do you think? And there's no stones, there's no silence. It's everybody now screams back, he's worthy of death. The whole Sanhedrin screaming, he's going to die. Then they spit in his face. Now, I don't remember that being part of the routine. And struck him with their fists. They're now beating him up. Others slap him and says, prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you? This is the second trial, and this is the way the ruling class of Jerusalem is dealing with the Messiah. They've completely broken down, and the high priest is leading the frenzy. Now, because it's in the law of Moses, you can't have a trial at night. And these men realize this, and they don't want to violate the law of Moses. And so they want to do this correctly. So they've made their decision, but we can't have this meeting until the sun comes up. Okay, well now they're just a few hours away, because if you read here, the next part, it says Peter, it talks about Peter denying Christ. Now Peter's watching this whole thing take place, and then a girl walks out from there and says, Peter, she's there, but warm himself on the fire, looking at it, she says, aren't you one of his disciples? Oh, no. And then he goes out the entrance, it tells you he goes out the entrance of the house and stands outside, and the same girl walks, says, aren't you him? No, I'm not him. And someone else says, he says, and he calls down curses and says, no, I'm not him. That's the next part here. And then it says, immediately, in verse 74, immediately a rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the words Jesus had spoken, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. In other words, why the rooster crow? Guess what? Sun's coming up. Oh, and the Sanhedrin's just waiting, because they do have some integrity. We don't want to have a night trial and condemn a man to death at night. Let's just wait. Here comes the sun, and that's their third trial. Now they're going to have the official trial. This next trial, where the Sanhedrin would normally meet, they never met at the high priest's palace. That's not where the Sanhedrin... They met at the temple in a room going around the temple, which called the Hall of Judgment, where they would sit and everything was orderly. They may have moved the whole thing to the temple during the next few minutes to get there so that when the sun came up, they could, in 5 or 10 minutes, redo the trial. Because in chapter 27, verse 1, are you ready? This is it for today. Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. In other words, they've already, you know, hollered out, he's worthy of death, and spit on him and beat him up, he's bleeding. And now they may have taken him across town to the temple, got the Sanhedrin all in their little seats, and everybody's in position now. The sun's come up, hey, we've got a legal trial now. What is your decision? It's all vote. They all put their little stones there. Well, it looks like he's guilty. And then they're taking him where to? They're going to take him to Pilate. We'll have to pick up with this next week if I remember. In verse 2, they bound him and led him away to be handed over to Pilate, the governor. But at this time right here, if I remember, we'll do this next week. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned by the Sanhedrin, he returns to the high priest, takes the 30 pieces of silver, and says, I was wrong. I did wrong. Judas now testifies, I did something wrong. What's going to be interesting now, he's going to take that money instead of giving it back. And this is why we think this is probably in the temple, is he takes the money, the 30 pieces of silver, and throws it into the sanctuary, the actual temple, throws it into there, and the priests go, oh, should have done that. Because they would have, if he would have gave it to them, they could have used it. He would have put in an offering, they could have used it. If he would have left it laying on the street, come and found it, they could have used it. But he throws the 30 coins into the sanctuary, into the holy place. The holy place. It's like, gosh. Now they've got to take that money out and they've got to do something with it. And they call it, guess what they're going to call it? They're going to call it blood money. Because it was guilt money. They used it to bribe somebody. Because now they've all come back, they're all coming back to say, we can't use this money to purchase anything. We've got to use it for something unclean because this is guilt money that we use to betray somebody. And so they're going to end up buying a field. And we're going to talk about that, what field they bought next week, if I remember. And then we've got Pilate's trial, ships him over to Herod, and back to Pilate, and then Jesus ends up crucified by 9 o'clock. We'll pray, and we'll pick this up next week. Father, we do thank you again for your word. We thank you for this information. Father, we do ask that the things that we would see, the character traits of people, the character traits of Peter, even of Jesus Christ as he walks in your will, the coolness, the calmness, the understanding that he has, we ask that this might be part of our lives. Again, Father, we thank you for what Jesus Christ did, that he took on the sin of the world, that we may be saved, that we may, again, walk in the freedom of Christ. Father, we ask that we may use that freedom to bring you glory and to do what is right in our own times. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.